listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. If you spent any time in Portland, Oregon in the 60s and 70s, the name Katz was quite an important moniker. Vera Katz was a political force, and Mel Katz, the founder of the great art space Portland Center for the Visual Arts, was also a great force in the art world there. These two wise Portlanders, the parents of writer Jesse Katz, both appear in their son's beautiful and poignant memoir, The Opposite Field, which is set in Monterey Park, California, as well as in Portland and Nicaragua and Mexico. Not only is Jesse Katz a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, he also served as his son Max's baseball coach and later as the unlikely savior and baseball commissioner of the Monterey Park Sports Club at La Loma Park. La Loma is the flashpoint for Katz's memoir, which the LA Times called, quote, equal parts personal journey, baseball book, immigrant tale, and cultural anthropology lesson. It is ultimately an LA story about how disparate cultures come together and form a community. Jesse Katz has been writing about Los Angeles for the better part of three decades, for 15 years as a staff writer at the LA Times, then as a senior writer at Los Angeles Magazine. He received the Penn Center USA's Literary Journalism Award and the James Beard Foundation's MFK Fisher Distinguished Writing Award. He was also a National Magazine Award nominee. He teaches in the Literary Journalism Program at UC Irvine, and he has volunteered in the juvenile justice system through a program called Inside Out Writers. I think you'll hear more about that tonight as well. In conversation with Jesse tonight is his compadre, Father Gregory J. Boyle. In 1988, Father Boyle began what would become Homeboy Industries, now located in downtown LA. How many of you have eaten at Homegirl Cafe? Yes, great food. Since Father Greg, who's also known affectionately as G-Dog, started Homeboy Industries nearly 20 years ago, it has served members of more than half of the gangs in Los Angeles. He's the recipient of many prizes, and he is the author of the just released, and I mean just released as of last night, Tattoos on the Heart, Stories of Hope, Compassion, and Unconditional Love, which he will be reading and discussing and celebrating with us at Aloud on May 13th. Tonight we turn to an opposite field. Please welcome Jesse Katz and Father Gregory Boyle. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. It's a great privilege to be with all of you. I've received lots of honors in my life. Being called Jesse Katz's compadre is probably one of the highest. If you know Jesse from reading the LA Times or Los Angeles Magazine, and I sure hope you know him through this book, The Opposite Field, I recommend that you buy it. It's magnificent reading. It's filled with heart and mess and community and kinship and all the things that we long to create in our lives. If you ask any writer about Jesse Katz, they always say the exact same thing. Jesse Katz, what a great writer. He truly is a writer. Having just finished a book myself, this is why I hate Jesse, because he's such a good writer. So we met 20 years ago when Jesse was at a time when newspapers, or at least LA Times anyway, had a gang beat person. Maybe if somebody from the LA Times is here and will say we still do, but nobody had it like that. No paper in the country had somebody like Jesse, who was tenacious and young and eager and found his way into
and foolish,
the trust,
a little foolish,
into the trust and confidence of gang members and law enforcement alike. But tonight we talk about The Opposite Field. Again, I recommend that you buy this book after this event. It will really make you feel quite elevated and indeed happy to be a human being and part of this community of kinship. So I'm going to ask Jesse to begin by kind of giving us an aerial view, especially for those who haven't read the book, explain the title and explain, maybe read something as well that will indicate kind of what the scope of the book is.
Yeah, sure. I'll read a section that I think kind of sets up my relationship with my son, Max, and who begins in this book as a t-baller when he's 6 years old and finishes with him heading off to high school when he's 14, and he's 16 now and a junior in high school. And our relationship to this park, La Loma Park, which is in the city of Monterey Park. And I think you'll get a sense very quickly that even though this is a book ostensibly about Little League, and there's baseball being played, and it's got all that kind of darkly absurd, surreal quality of youth sports and adults behaving badly and grown-up egos, you know, imposing themselves on a children's game, that it's ultimately about some other things that are more important to me, about family and community and parenthood and relationships and my relationship with this kid. Who is, you know, the center of my life, is really the dominant thread in this story, and watching him grow up and trying to hold on and extend this childhood and keep him as a boy, and yet knowing, for those of you who have teenagers or grown children, knowing how hard it is to let go and wanting to sort of preserve that relationship, but recognizing that if he's going to become whatever it is that he's destined to be, you know, I need to allow him to make some of his own mistakes. On those nights when Max and I linger, when the fog rolls in and the Pomona freeway thrums like an ocean, La Loma's return to us, cool and still and hushed. The cray paper Cinco de Mayo flowers that brightened our opening ceremony droop from the chain link backstops. The fields I watered and raked that afternoon swirl again with lime and dust. Sunflower husks, peanut shells, popcorn kernels, the detritus of baseball, mix again with the soil. Up in the power lines, an owl hoots and flaps, the same owl, I'm guessing, that swooped into our backyard a dozen blocks away and absconded with Max's guinea pigs not long after his mother and I split up. I think of the chatter, the whoops and belly aches that moments earlier filled La Loma, the allegiances and grievances that percolate through every season, both inside and outside the baselines. All of it created by us, by parents and children inhabiting the same space, imagining the same future. La Loma is not a gymnasium. Nobody shows up just for a time slot. It is a village, our city upon the hill, tangled and mushy and occasionally petty, but always stewing. People mill and wander, gossip and gripe, investing themselves in something larger than the score or the standings, something beyond a team or a league or a game. Here I'll talk a little bit about the title. Going to the opposite field takes patience, perspective, humility. If a batter's always trying to impose his will on the ball, a right-hander's tendency being to swing for the left field fences, he'll never be able to handle the unexpected pitch, outside, breaking, off speed. By trying to pull it, he'll more often than not be out ahead, waving at air, and even if he does get a piece, it's unlikely to result in anything but a feeble dribbler. His strength becomes his weakness. To go the other way, to slap a single through the infield or drive a double into the gap, is to choose contact over power. It means sacrificing ego, holding back, adjusting. The hitter takes what is given and goes with it, making the most of a pitch that was never his to begin with. I've tried to teach this lesson to Max with varying degrees of success. At the plate, he still gets impatient, too eager to pounce. I hope in the process, that he figures it out off the field as well, that he understands how this park, our town, the way we've chosen to live, all follow the same contrary rule. The more I've devoted myself to baseball, to La Loma, the more I've come to realize that I've been cultivating something else, something said not to exist in Los Angeles, something hard to find anywhere in America. not a sense of community, not the pious or politicized versions, but the real thing, tangible, human, imperfect, at once motley and utterly square. This is the L.A. I know and believe in, an L.A. more satisfying than any of its myths generally allow for. Or maybe it's because of those myths, because L.A. is the capital of artifice and celebrity and unsteady earth, that an environment as unfashionable, as rooted as La Loma, is so hard for me to resist. Before we leave, I pull out the bases. I comb the dugouts for a last fistful of trash. I peek under the bleachers and inside the bathrooms. I swing the parking gate shut, tugging the padlocks to make sure they have latched. Some nights, as we head down the hill, I wonder what it is about me, about my yearnings and voids, that compels me to do this. Some nights I think, just maybe, I've found the place I belong.
Jesse, can you say something about the kind of contrary approach that you took? You mentioned about parents behaving badly, and not only did you inherit sort of a sports club that was somewhat in disarray, I guess, but you also wanted to impress your own kind of way of seeing, you know, how this ought to be for kids. You know, there was a sense of not putting on this pressure to win necessarily.
Yeah, well, I should say, you know, I stepped into this league, this sports club, a youth recreational league, fairly innocently. I just wanted to coach my son in t-ball, and I was more or less oblivious to everything that was going on around me. But as the years went by, it became clear that this park that we cherished, that we cared so much about, was being looted and trampled by this kind of blustery old guard that had, you know, mined it for money and prestige. And so by the time Max was 10, I believe, we were getting ready to start his fifth season in the park, and we discovered that everything had fallen apart, that families had bailed out and equipment was missing, and I didn't realize it at the time, but thousands of dollars in debt had been racked up. And I sort of, you know, naively or nobly or arrogantly or foolishly nominated myself to be the commissioner of this organization and be the leader of this messy little society on top of a hill. So I suddenly made this transition from coach, from parent to coach to commissioner. And you know, I had a way of coaching. I had a sort of I guess I thought it was important to care, but not to care too much. But I also, as the commissioner, where I'm responsible for everybody's experience in this park, I really felt that my job was considerably more than just hosting baseball games. I was more than the scheduler and more than the administrator or keeping the trains running on time. That this was about, you know, selling an experience. You were inviting people into a park. I was asking them to trust in my leadership and believe that I was the right person to do this. But I was also, you know, I was asking the best of them too. I was asking them to sort of rise up and claim this space for themselves and turn it from a place that had been corrupted into you know, a very important part of our community.
Which raised the question for me, having just written a book, and the lawyers at Simon & Schuster said, change all the names. You have a part here in the acknowledgments. Not a single name has been changed or characters stitched together. No performances have been enhanced. So you're not morphing scenes or people. But all I could think of was, you know, the folks who were sort of swindled you out of money or who bullied you, or everybody from Carmen to Eddie to on and on. I'm thinking, my God, these are the names. And all I could think of was, you know, well, first of all, how did the people at Crown let you do that? Or how does that work?
I'm sure there's great legal minds there that that allowed that to happen. If you read the language very carefully, you'll notice that nobody is accused of any crimes.
Anything illegal, yeah.
That was what the Crown cared about the most, is any insinuation of illegal behavior. So where I had said maybe that somebody, I said it very casually here, the park was looted, right? But in the book, where I said somebody looted the park, we changed that to trampled, because looting was a crime. Trampling still sounds pretty bad, but it's not a crime.
But even that, the fact that adults are behaving badly and you're telling the world that they are and they're using their names, because you still see these people, I'm sure, no?
I've bumped into some of the people that are in the book. I mean, I live where I've always lived, in Monterey Park. Most people who were involved in our baseball league know where to find me if they want to find me. I was surprised that I was given that leeway to use people's names. I can't really explain it other than that I was told that as a memoirist, I have the right to write my own story. I have the right to tell my experiences. And obviously that involves other people. I felt
pull punches. You don't...
Well, I felt it was really important.
I'm very honest, you know.
Once you start changing names and maybe there's some composite characters, I feel, as a reader, when I open a book and I see that some names have been changed and maybe there's, you begin to doubt, like, how much more was altered, yeah. What other liberties were taken. And I feel that, one of the strengths of this book is that there is that brutal honesty, and you know that this is exactly how it took place. And yes, I say some impolite things and reveal some messy details about my own life and my neighbors' lives, but I'm not playing with it. It's mm-hmm. not cute. It's not coy. It's real. It's what we lived, and that brutal honesty, that harsh light is, it's aimed at other people, but it's very much, I think you would agree, aimed back at myself. I mean, mm-hmm. I subject myself to a level of scrutiny. Sure. and sort of discuss my foibles and imperfections, mm-hmm. In the exact same way. It's not like I'm sitting atop the hill, just pointing fingers at other people.
Mm-hmm. I was several times in the book you talk about your barrio pass, and sort of earned by having learned your Spanish and going to Mexico and a relationship with Susan and trying to kind of wanting to have that grasp on the culture. Even at some point later on, you mentioned that you were no longer adapting to East Side culture. You were, in fact, introducing it and presenting it to the world in Monterey Park, really. That you had, talk a little bit about that cultural shift, or why is that important to you, the kind of the learning of the Spanish and understanding that culture, and even the barrio pass.
Well, you were one of the first people to stamp mine, I think. Right. I should
I'm
say
a checkpoint.
I should say, I know you guys know who Father Greg is and his role in this community, but for me to share this stage with you, Greg, is just an enormous honor. I've known Greg for 18 years, and I was a young, naive, late 20s reporter, and trying to figure my way around LA, and thrown into this gang beat where I was, arguably an unlikely person for that assignment. And there were, there's different ways to go about learning about the gang world. And I think the old-fashioned way was you did a ride-along with a gang detective. You go out with LAPD Crash, right? And you'd look through the window and they'd point out graffiti and tell you what things were like. And I didn't want to do it that way. I wanted to go out on the street and talk to the people I was writing about. And, you were one of those people that welcomed me into a community where, and by superficial appearances, I didn't belong. And not only did you allow me to be there and share your experience with me, but you allowed me to view the world through your eyes, you know, you were surrounded by people who were viewed as, you know, unreachable and irredeemable, and you saw those qualities that said, no, that there's more to them. And, you know, the enormous risks that you've taken, both, you know, putting yourself in harm's way, but, you know, emotional risks. You care for people, invest in people who are likely to let you down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you offer your love to people who, you know, might die on you, who do die on you, who you bury, and to watch you do that and see that your compassion doesn't dry up through all that. I mean, that shaped not just the stories that I was doing in 1992, but, you know, that shaped my view of Los Angeles and my, you know, my view of humanity. And it's something that I hope kind of runs through this book as well. So much of this book is, I mean, the title, The Opposite Field, has lots of, you know, connotations, but a big part of it is kind of reaching across that divide and getting out of our comfort zone. And you know, we're so isolated in Los Angeles. We live in our little pockets, and there's so much of the city that is thought of as being off limits. You know, you can't go there. It's the bad area. And you know, what I've tried to do in my life, in my professional life, but my personal life too, and where I live and who I've had relationships with is all about that adventurousness, and that I think there's humility in there and there's compassion. And what you discover is that, you know, if you extend your hand across that chasm, you know, the other, whatever you think that other is, turns out to be not so alien at all.
And that's what's so beautiful about the village of La Loma, because you accomplish this, you know, in your times as the commissioner. But say something about the ethnic kind of, how unique that area was, you know, and still is. I presume it's sort of unchanging in the nine seasons that you were involved.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all of the action in this book, or most of it, takes place in Monterey Park, which is about 9 miles east of here. But it's, you know, it's sort of an anonymous, easily overlooked part of Los Angeles. And if it's known, it's known mostly for being the most Asian community in the continental United States. My son goes to public high school. It's over 70% Asian. And when we moved to Monterey Park in 1998, it had just sort of completed its transformation. Over the previous two decades, 20,000 white folks had pulled up their stakes and left Monterey Park, which was extraordinary. It was the most bizarre form of white flight, because Monterey Park was not in decline, and it was just the opposite. You had a professional class of immigrants with money to invest and opening shops and restaurants and building, and, you know, not to perpetuate certain stereotypes, but the schools were getting better, test scores were going up. It was a desirable community to be in. Now, a lot of those kids didn't play baseball at La Loma,
yeah.
Which is, you know, doesn't quite add up, because, you know, baseball's very Asian, and not just at the major league level, but, you know, Little League World Series teams,
sure,
from, you know, Taiwan and Japan and South Korea are, you know, dominate in that. And but there's something about the immigrant journey, the sacrifices that families have made to come to this country for the sake of their children, for their futures, that I think baseball, you know, throwing the ball around on a Saturday morning was a frivolity that they couldn't afford. That was, Saturday mornings were piano lessons and Mandarin classes. And the flip side is that, you know, we're right next to East LA. East LA, Montebello, El Sereno. We have, you know, a huge... you know, the heart of Mexican America is in our backyard, and for those families, our park and baseball represented something really different. It was kind of a symbol of mobility and assimilation. It was American.
They had arrived, really.
It was redemption. It was often making up for experiences they didn't have when they were kids, or even, you know, mistakes they made when they were adults. You know, we definitely had coaches with prison records and gang tattoos, and you know, there were some people I recognized. They were familiar to me, and you know, I got to where I would joke that I was the white Jewish commissioner of the Mexican League in a Chinese city, and. But to me, that's those, you know, those contradictions and juxtapositions are what make LA, you know, a great place.
When you took over as commissioner, you have a line in there where you say, I kept hearing, you're a better man than I am. And then Jesse writes, which of course is not what people mean when they say it. And so there was a sense. So what do people mean when they say that?
You know,
mental,
you know, you're a freaking idiot, right?
The thing I love that it's repeated throughout, and maybe you could unpack this a little bit, you know, where people would do this little, as we would say in Spanish, indirecta. Oh, I thought this was supposed to be for the kids. And you say this often, and people would find refuge in that line. And so what does that mean exactly? Or how what are people manipulating you to?
It became, you know, sort of a mantra that you'd hear, and anyone who has any experience in a soccer league or baseball or basketball, you'll hear it all the time. It's for the kids, anything for the kids. And yeah, of course, I mean, that's where our hearts are. But I began to realize that the people who said that and said it over and over were often covering up for, you know, if not their misdeeds, at least their own ego and ambition. It was never for the kids. I mean, there's there's too much invested. There's too much sacrificed. You know, people spend money at this and time, and they devote themselves. And the kids can come to enjoy it. They can come to, you know, relish that experience, but 6 and 7 year old kids don't really decide on their own that this is what they want. I mean, it's a lot of pressure. It's tense.
Yeah.
It's parents that decide this is good for my child. This is the experience we want to have. And you know, it's not always nefarious, but it was never. I mean, even for myself, you know, I can say that my heart was in it for my son, but I had all these other complicated, you know, complicated personal motivations, internal motivations for wanting to do this.
But, you know, the opposite field is also like, this is a Jesuit concept, which is agere contra, you know, to go against. It's a little bit of you want to kind of go in one door and come out another door. Like, for example, the water balloons. Why don't you explain what that's... Maybe you can read from
Should
it.
I read that section? Yeah. Do you know where it is?
I have no idea. But you have those stick-it notes that you must...
I don't know that that's part of my standard spiel.
But for me, it was an image of, yeah, this is different in terms of creating an experience for kids.
Yeah, I found it.
Okay.
This was a scene. I think this was my first year as commissioner, and this is one of my hidden motivations. It wasn't the most significant one, but we had a team. We were coming back for our second year in the same age division, which meant we could keep our group of kids together one more year before we moved up and the team would scatter and they'd have to form again. And I didn't want to lose this season, partly because we were going to come back and we were going to be the champions. You know, I was the commissioner to preside over the coronation of my son's team. It didn't quite work out that way, and you know, we lost to one of my to Lulu Magallon, one of my loyal opponents. And I know we're going to lose this game, and I can see it. So I come prepared, and I have so anyway, the game's over. The other team is celebrating their win, and I have my kids, and I'm giving them, you know, the spiel, and I swing open the lid of this cooler. I'd spent the afternoon in my kitchen filling it with water balloons, dozens of them, knowing the likelihood that we would be in need of consolation. Our side of the field, the loser's side, was suddenly pandemonium, so loud and delirious that Lulu's kids stopped their celebration to see what had gotten into us. I grabbed a balloon and went hunting for Max, stalking him through the scattering herd. The sun was down, but the night was balmy again, the park buzzing with moths and mosquitoes. I spotted that mop of hair under the lights. Gotcha, I yelled. I raised my arm. A balloon hit my back. Then another. I was getting ambushed. The water splashing my neck, soaking my jersey, sending muddy rivulets down my arms and legs. Whoever was doing it, I could pay back later. I did not want Max to get away. Dripping, shivering, I heaved the balloon. It smacked him on the rear and bounced harmlessly onto the grass. Nice try, Pops, Max said. He bent down and grabbed it for himself, and now he was running with a sly grin back toward me.
That's great. You know, a lot of times people will, you want to kind of pigeonhole a book. This is a baseball book. And certainly, that's what people sometimes will erroneously say, and I think every review has kind of tried to kind of say, don't just say it's a baseball book. But certainly if you love baseball, and especially it evokes kind of a childhood, at least, you know, organizing baseball cards and putting that crummy oil on the mitt and putting the, you know, the ball in the webbing and putting it on the mattress. For me, it was just this great nostalgic moment of kind of reliving all that. But it's a father and son book, of course. But it's also a son and mother, son and father book. And Louise mentioned your mom. And that's not just the cancer saga, which you described with great, quite vivid and heartbreaking and noble and courageous, but also her, when it forced you to kind of go back and figure out who she was and kind of do your own research as a reporter, really. So let's talk about a little bit of that, about your mom.
Yeah, you know, really for both of my parents, as I'm writing this book and I'm trying to come to terms, you know, with what are the lessons that I've taught Max and have I always taught him what I think I'm teaching him, or am I betraying myself in some ways? I wanted to figure out, you know, who my parents were and get to know better, you know, their legacy to me. And it both kind of reaffirmed and redefined my relationships with them. My father, as Louise mentioned, is an artist. he's still a sculptor. He's 77 and goes to the studio every day and makes sculpture that's abstract and minimalist. And it's, you know, it's not a pretty picture to put in the wall. It's difficult stuff. But when I was a kid, when I was Max's age, you know, I was very aware that I had the artsy dad. You know, other dads carried a briefcase and put on a tie and went to the office. And, you know, I thought I had the laid back dad. So I would call, his name's Melvin. I would call him Mellow Mel. And it was only later in life watching him do this for decades and decades and you know, seeing the labor and the sweat and tears and literally worked his arm down to the bone, lost all the cartilage in his shoulder and had to have, you know, a titanium ball and socket put in there. You know, he gave everything to these sculptures. And I began to see him in a different light and realize, you know, there's actually something courageous and even severe about, you know, the rigor that he approaches this work with. And my mom was kind of the flip side. My mom, I'd always thought of her as sort of the nervous, workaholic, very tightly wound mom. And then when she got ill, I began to see her in a more vulnerable and sentimental light, and I went back and I retraced her story. My mother was the daughter of Russian revolutionaries. Her parents, my grandparents, were Mensheviks and helped overthrow the Tsar in 1917. And but then were immediately you know, taken over by the Bolsheviks and had to flee and go into exile. And so my mother was born in Germany, in Dusseldorf, in 1933. And that was the year that Hitler rose to power. And so the next thing, this exile family has to flee Germany and go to France. And my mom lived her essentially her first 6 years in Paris until the Nazi army came into France and was forced to flee again. And this time they went over the Pyrenees, escaped by foot, were smuggled over the mountains from France into Spain, and eventually caught a boat and arrived in America. And she spoke French and Russian and landed in New York.
No English.
And no English, and said from that day on she was American and she was going to never speak these languages again. And went on. I mean, my mom's this sort of extraordinary immigrant success story. She ran for the Oregon legislature when she was 40 years old, and went on to become the Speaker of the House, the second woman in the U.S. to preside over a state assembly, and then the mayor of Portland for 12 years. And what I was able to do in the course of my research was go to Paris. Yeah, it was a tough job, but I had to do it. And you don't get to fly to Paris for tax deductible reasons too often. So I was on this journey, I was able to find the lady who helped smuggle my mom over the Pyrenees. She was 89 years old, and she would die 7 or 8 months after I met her. So it was this sort of extraordinary moment to find her and have her still be alive, and it was this emotional meeting and very poignant, and she was so thrilled. There were people, she had shuttled hundreds of people through the Pyrenees, but not many of them knew who had helped her, and she didn't necessarily know who she was helping. To have somebody come back and thank her and say, you saved my mother's life. And she gave me her maps. She gave me photographs. Wow. And sent me on my way. So I was able to retrace my mom's footsteps, and I hiked over the Pyrenees myself. And
do you have something to read, a Vera section?
Yeah. My editor at Crown Books did say, how are you going to weave that stuff into this Little League story? And I said,
trust me, he does it.
Said very artfully. there's a scene with my mom where, I should also say, I grow up in Portland, Oregon, and I have these very public and accomplished parents, and the first thing I did was, I ran away. I came to Los Angeles. I came to the Forbidden Land. If you grew up in the Pacific Northwest, this is the devil's playground. You're trained from birth to think this is the worst place on the planet. So, I felt I was doing something kind of rebellious, and I felt that, and then my mom got ill, and I went up to see her, and I began to reevaluate our relationship. On the June day that I finally flew up to see her, my head was swirling with doubts and guilt. I kept thinking how sad it was that I had allowed myself to become this estranged from my mom, from what had once been my home. It felt like an era was ending in Portland. Even if the chemo worked, I was reminded that my parents were not going to be around forever, that the experiment that had brought them out from New York was winding to a close. Sooner or later, they would be gone, and then what? So would the Katzes. These two remarkable people who had uprooted their young family and in separate ways helped Portland evolve into what it is now would be survived by a lone heir who had left the minute he became an adult. They had made Portland their own, and I had refused to be defined as their son. Dad picked me up from the airport and took me straight to the hospital. She looked small. An oxygen line was clipped to her nose. An IV drip was taped to her arm. A dialysis machine was drawing blood from a port in her chest. I bent down to hug her and felt mostly bones. She was maybe half of what she had been. When I let go, we both had tears in our eyes. How did I lose you? She asked. Something became clear to me at that moment, something I had been only vaguely aware of on the plane. All this time, I thought I was running, disrupting patterns, subverting expectations. I was doing just what my parents had dedicated their lives to. I was investing myself in a community, in a culture, in a game, in a park, fixing, rescuing. I had come from someplace else, and yet I had really not traveled so far. I wiped my face with my sleeve. "I am the way I am," I said, "because you are the way you are." I did not want her to feel bad about that. "This is your gift to me, Mom." Beautiful.
Go ahead and clap. We're about to take some questions. I want to ask one last thing, and that's the in the epilogue, you agree to be the JV coach at the high school where Max is going, and you're kind of slick because you think, well, I'm going to be the JV coach because then my freshman son, he's good enough that he'll be elevated to the JVs. But to your surprise, he ends up getting snatched by the varsity, and so you not only can't coach him, but he's playing on an opposite field, and so his games are exactly at the same time as yours are, and you can't watch him. But I thought it was sort of this.
So you just gave away the end of the book.
Oh, I'm sorry. Uh-oh. Spoiler alert. God, I did do that, didn't I? But I also want to kind of get a sense of, I'm sorry. But it feels like an image of how you're so connected to this kid, and then this thing happens, you know, where you kind of let go. You have a light grasp. There are moments in the book when you have this, you know, like when he's sort of the skateboard teenage kid that you know, is maybe not as communicative as he had been. But there's all these little losses of he's not the kid he was, you know, because he's growing up. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
But just that idea of how in the end it changes.
Well, I
go ahead and read from the epilogue so I don't feel so bad.
Actually, I thought I would read a little exchange with Max that, and then I can mention talk about the epilogue. When he's 13, he becomes skater boy, and suddenly he's long hair rocker,
Team Gonzo,
and doesn't want basically. Coach Dad is being laid off here, and you know he wants to have his own experience out there on the streets, and so I'm sort of, you know, there's this real melancholy kind of wistful, almost morose feeling as I'm realizing I'm losing him. You know, he's becoming somebody beyond my grasp, and so there's a part where I describe that. He would flex his biceps for me, then his abs. And dare me to punch him as hard as I could. I noticed that he had begun to pluck his eyebrows and that he was dousing himself in some drugstore body spray that smelled of citrus and leather. His showers were getting longer, the bathroom door consistently locked. He was spending a lot of time on MySpace, IMing with an enticing Vietnamese girl from school, but as best as I could tell, skating also came before romance, and for that I was grateful. The U.S. Army had somehow flagged Max, and recruiters were leaving messages on his cell, trying to woo him into becoming a soldier. Having just spent half a year on a story about the life of a new enlistee, I knew how the spiel went. Someone had to serve, but my son was not fair game. "The next time those fuckers call," I told them, "you're putting me on the phone." If I did something that Max approved of, say, spiff myself up in a creased Pendleton, or do an interview with Ice Cube, he would tell me that I was gangster. Not a gangster. It was an adjective spoken with varying degrees of irony to indicate fortitude and panache. If I did something that Max associated with weakness, say, listen to the Dixie Chicks, or wear my Crocs out in public, he would call me a fruit. As for himself, he had concocted another alias, a stage name that sounded half porn star, half pro wrestler, M. Fury. It was written on his social studies notebook. We were as close as ever, but the balance of power was shifting. My influence was eroding, and his invincibility was off the charts.
Agnes.
So then we have this.
Go ahead.
The final, we'll just address the epilogue.
Yeah, sure.
At the very end, I mean, I was writing the book. I got a book contract from Crown. I took some time off of my LA Magazine job, and I'm at home writing the book, and they needed baseball coaches at his high school, and I had a little free time in the afternoon, so I decided I'm going to become a baseball coach one more time. And the program was kind of broken at his high school, and they needed bodies. And I do all this scheming to think, you know, how am I going to coach Max's team? And he's a freshman, so I'm going to be the JV coach. I'm going to bring him up with me. And then yes, he leapfrogs right past. And I realized, you know, I had done all the scheming. I was trying so hard to hold on to this thing, to preserve this relationship, to extend this boyhood experience, and I'd screwed myself out of the chance to watch him play baseball. He's on the opposite field, and at that point, I realized, you know, the time's come to step back myself and let him do his thing, yeah. And just make sure that I'm always there for him, you know, cheering in the bleachers.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful book. We're going to, I'm going to invite you to just raise your hand, and I think they have a microphone down here. And we're going to yield the balance of our time to anybody up there in the back.
Beautiful writing. It's great to be here. You know, you're a journalist. You've been working as a journalist with the LA Times, and a memoir is kind of a different type of beast. What was it difficult to make that transition to have that more internally focused writing through the book, or is this something that you've been doing in other pieces?
No, it was deathly painful. You know, I've spent 25 years peeking behind other people's masks, you know, trying to figure out what makes them tick underneath. And you know, sometimes, you know, it's rough. We want to keep these messy details under wraps, and to turn that on myself, and you know, explore my own life with that same intensity and that same journalistic rigor was rough. You know, I'm looking at the computer screen every day, and it ceased to be a screen. You know, it turned into a mirror, and it's reflecting back all these patterns and predilections that I was, you know, only vaguely conscious of. And, you know, what I found, I mean, the really challenging part of that equation is you know, Jesse Katz is a character in this book. I'm the author, but I'm also, I'm a character who's in these scenes and who's part of the action and part of the narrative. And, you know, that character is kind of bumbling sometimes and self-deluded and you know, makes some boneheaded choices, which is okay. You know, that's life, and that was my life, and so it's okay for him to act that way as a character in the story, but as the narrator, as the person who's presenting the information and making sense of it, I need to be a little wiser than the Jesse Katz in the book. And so it's that shifting of perspective where I'm describing myself in the moment, and then I'm able to step back and understand who this person is. And the problem was, you know, you start writing this and you don't necessarily have that wisdom that you're supposed to have. You're still the deluded guy in the book. So as you know, there was a process as I'm writing this that I'm going, crap, I gotta make some sense of things here. I gotta make sense of my life, and quick. So yeah, that was a difficult transition.
Jesse, a couple quick points. I'm glad you brought up the issue of win at all costs in these little leagues, and expose that. My son was one of the top players in the soccer league, and I let him quit after 3 years, and the coaches called me for 2 years after that. Get that kid back there. It's totally ridiculous. Quirk of personal fate, I have two childhood friends that grew up on the street going up to La Loma. It's in the southeast quadrant of Monterey Park. Most of Monterey Park couldn't find it if you told them to look at it. Question, how did you find it such a compelling story just to begin with?
Well, you're right. I mean, we haven't really talked about the geography of La Loma, but La Loma it means the hill in Spanish, as you know, and it's on a hill and it's hidden, it's camouflaged from the street, and you could drive by and you know not even know that baseball's being played up there. It's such a wonderful environment. I think, you know, describing the meeting of these worlds of Asian Monterey Park and Latino Monterey Park and East LA and Montebello. And, you know, I think where worlds come together, where borders meet, there's tension, you know, and good tension a lot of times. I don't mean as necessarily racial tension. It's dramatic tension. And there's something about the Asian world and the Latino world meeting and the barrio and the burbs coming together and you know, working class LA and bedroom community LA, that and then you throw me in there and I don't really belong in any of those worlds and I'm trying to navigate it. If I had been the Little League commissioner of Sherman Oaks or Pacific Palisades, I don't think I would have had as much to write about. I could be wrong, but you know, there'd be some baseball stories, and there'd probably be some parental drama, and maybe some of the adult predicaments that are in my book too. But I'm not sure that it would have been a window into LA. I'm not sure it would have opened up that sort of or aimed a mirror. I wouldn't have had as many transcendent qualities, and so I just, there was something about Monterey Park that to me was going to take you someplace maybe that you'd never been.
Anybody else? Oh, way down here.
Good evening. You indicated you were writing about gangs and living in an area that was Asian or maybe mostly Chinese. Did you write about the Chinese gangs?
I've had a few. I should untangle a couple threads of my life here. When I was the gang reporter for the LA Times, I wasn't living in Monterey Park. I was in Echo Park and Glendale, I think. And I did have a chance to write some Asian gang stories. There were some element of that. I mean, you can probably write a gang story for just about any culture or nationality or ethnic group. It's an equal opportunity experience. But, you know, the reality of Los Angeles, the reality of the demographics of LA and you know, the groups that feel most excluded meant that being the gang reporter, you were gonna spend most of your time in South LA or East LA, and you were gonna be writing about Latinos or African Americans. Not that it was exclusive to them, but that was the gang world of Los Angeles. But you know, since I've been living in Monterey Park, that's not really part of my thing.
That's where the East Side, the Boyle Heights gangs, live there, and they commute to my area. So it's, and you think I'm joking, but say something about Inside Out writers.
there's a scene in this book where I talk about my experiences volunteering in the juvenile justice system. I taught creative writing at Central Juvenile Hall and eventually at the Youth Authority facility in Chino through a program called Inside Out Writers, which does extraordinary work sending creative people into the juvenile system. And I did it for 6 or 7 years, and I'm talking in the book about how I would be at the park one day. I'd be at La Loma and I'd be working with kids in little Dodgers and Angels uniforms, and then I would get on you know, the freeway and go to Chino, and there's a different uniform. All these guys, guys in jailhouse dickies and everything, and in some ways they were the same kids. You know, they were I was at La Loma to try to keep some of those kids from becoming the guys in Chino, and some of the guys in Chino, if they'd had the opportunities to be part of a community like that, might not have ended up there. And the writing lessons were mostly to try to get them to stop worrying about correct writing. I mean, most of them didn't have formal grammatical and spelling skills. I mean, part of their inability to function that way is why they ended up locked up. You know, they couldn't function in a traditional school environment. And I would try to get them to silence that voice that would tell them they couldn't do this, they were no good at it, that they should just write honestly from the heart, and that honest writing was different from correct writing, and don't ask me how to spell a word, and doesn't matter what your penmanship is like, just open that faucet and let it pour out from inside onto the page. And most of them, as you know, I mean, have lived very dramatic lives, for better or worse. There's a lot of story to tell when you're doing that. And ultimately, it's not, you're not even teaching writing, right? You know, you're teaching faith, and you're teaching confidence and
self-esteem.
You're sharing. It's about generosity and teaching kids to who have been told they're worthless pretty much their whole life, other than maybe their gang brothers who have told them they're powerful. Having somebody from the outside come in and say, you can do this, mm-hmm. and it's meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk maybe one more question? Sure. Right over here.
Hello. At least reading the book. After college, you came to L.A. and you went to Echo Park. And then with the L.A. Times, you entrenched yourself in gang life, and you're the white guy on the gang beat. And then you're the commissioner of La Loma. And it seems as though you are very much at home being the stranger in the strange land. At what point in your life did you realize that that is the space that you feel most at home at, that you're most comfortable with?
There is a scene in the book where your description is accurate, I think, and there's a scene in the book where I have a girlfriend in college who goes to Mexico, and she's similar background of like myself, but goes to Mexico to study Spanish and take photographs and immerses herself in that world so easily, and I go down and visit her, and I just want to be with her, but she wants to introduce me to her experiences, and I discover that I'm absolutely unequipped to be in another culture, in another country, and I have something sort of bordering a nervous breakdown. I mean, I'm sobbing into my pillow, and I'm this pathetic little puppy dog, and I'd never felt that way before, and I never wanted to feel that way again. So we got back to college. And I decide, well, I'm gonna learn Spanish because I'm gonna keep up with her and be a worthy partner. And needless to say, that wasn't really what she wanted, because now I was competing with her. And
Chewy Gatos was not very appealing to her.
Yeah, that was my nom de plume.
Nom de big mistake.
I started learning Spanish for all the wrong reasons, because a girl broke my heart, and then I got to LA, and I think when I first arrived here, it was 1985, and I'd grown up in a very open-minded, progressive world of Portland, Oregon, but also, you know, very homogeneous environment. And I had gone to college in Vermont, in Bennington, Vermont, which was even whiter than Portland. And I got to LA, and it was just overwhelming. It was this sort of kaleidoscopic experience. And I would just drive, as I say in the book, I would drive the streets, you know, Vermont and Western and Pico and Olympic and Beverly, and I'd just be like marveling at, you know, the world was here. And I was not very good at navigating it, but I became sort of obsessed and consumed with trying to figure it out, to try to show that I could. That I wasn't squeamish. I wouldn't be scared off, I think that sense of wonderment and curiosity and wanting to prove that I belonged, that I could hold my ground in an environment that was that unfamiliar to me, that was my initiation to LA, and I think that carried its way through the kind of journalism I did, and ultimately, you know, the place I called home in Monterey Park.
Please buy this book in the lobby, and Jesse will sign it for you. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you all. Appreciate you being here.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakci Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.